Okay, so from what you can tell from the title of my presentation, I'm going to talk more about failures rather than successes. Apologies for that. And also, I will not talk about the last 20 years, but I will talk about the last 120 years of Greek history in a condensed form in 15 minutes, and I hope I will be able to make sense. All right, let's see. In outline, what I will try to do is that I will begin with some theoretical remarks, theory light, don't worry about that. Then I will focus on three crises, past crises in Greece, of long duration, though. And then I will describe those crises as spirals of crisis, as black holes, if you like, that a country may enter, Greece in this case, from out of which it is very difficult to escape. So I will talk about how Greece got into those crises and how Greece got out of those crises in the past. And then I will invite you to do some forecasting about the future. Now, what is democratic modernization? In my sense, it is an achieved situation of steady socioeconomic progress based on and propelled by legitimate liberal democratic institutions. So the key word here is legitimacy, if you like, legitimation, which is something that is not, it is not out there to be picked up, bought, or sold. It is something to be attained. It is something to be achieved. So the history of Greece, like the history of many nations, of democracies, I mean, is the history of trying to achieve legitimation, social legitimation. We'll come back to this a number of times. So the key question here in my presentation is how democratic modernization may fail. Okay, so this is the question we are concerned about, aren't we? There are many theories, many general theories about that. I will not go into them. Theories that have to do with the economy in general, strong economies versus weak economies, for example. Theories that have to do with institutions, weak institutions, strong institutions, etc. Culture, modernizing cultures, less modernizing cultures, underdogs, blah, blah, blah. Dependency theories, many of them, which depend on it means that, you know, they have to do with strong nations, dominating nations versus weak, dominant nations. I will not take any of those approaches. I'm not very much in favor of big theories, but I will try an alternative theory here, a small one, simple, according to which modernization succeeds or fails when a political system enjoys broad and solid social legitimation. That is my main point. Good idea, you will say. But again, how does this legitimation, what does it consist of, and how is that achieved? How is that attained, right? Good answer, good questions. So in my research, by looking back in previous Greek experiences, but in other countries as well, I'm a comparativist, by the way, I find three reasons that are very, very important, and those three reasons are highly closely interrelated and mutually reinforcing. Okay? All of those are very important. One of those is more important than the others, but you will understand later on which one I mean. So the three factors that you need to achieve social legitimation in a country, any country, but we're talking about Greece here. Sorry about that. I can see my screen. Oh, yeah. There. Thanks. So the first factor is competent leadership. The second factor is social parliamentarism. This means competent leadership means efficient and effective leadership. I will not go very much into that. Solid parliamentarism means that parliamentary democratic politics happen within the parliament and not outside of that. And finally, a robust, vivid, active, entrepreneurial middle class. All of those factors are necessary. My key point in this presentation is that when at least one of those factors is missing, then you have a very, very high likelihood for a failure of modernization in the beginning of a spiral of crisis. Now, spirals of crisis. The crisis that I'm going to focus on, I'm going to focus on three spirals of crisis, and as I said, I conceive of spirals as black holes. There are three of them. One begins in 1893 in Greece and ends in 1910. It lasts 17 years. The second one begins in 1935 and goes all the way up to 1952, 17 years as well. And a third one that begins in 1961 and it ends in 1974. Now we're in the fourth spiral, which began in 2008, in December, I believe, and it is ongoing. But I'm dropping this out because I'm not going to focus on the present crisis very much. Now, there are two issues at hand here. How do nations, how did Greece enter into those spirals I mentioned earlier, and how did it exit from that? So let me take those points one by another and talk first about entering into those crisis spirals. Now, in all of those three spirals I mentioned, there have been a number of triggers. In 1993, the trigger was the bankruptcy of Greece. In 1935, it was a military coup that followed another military coup in 1933. And in 1961, we have demagoguery, street politics. Now, I will try to explain very, very briefly that in all of those three cases, none of those factors for legitimation existed. Okay, all of those were gone. And this is why we had those crises, and this is why they lasted so long. So leadership was poor or faulty in all three cases. So you see Trikoupis, Venizelos, and George Papandreou here. I don't mean to say that those were not good leaders. They were. But when the crisis occurred, okay, those leaders behaved in a very poor, politically poor way. Why? For a number of reasons. First, all of those suffer from fatigue, from age. Those were very old by that time, by the standards of the times, of course. All of those suffer from declining political clout, very sharply, actually. All three of them were faced with intra-party rivalries, and two of those, Venizelos and Papandreou, behaved opportunistically. Okay? Trikoupis was exiled in Cannes, and then he died there. Second factor, extra-parliamentarism. So politics taking or occurring mostly outside the parliament and not inside of that. Again, in all three cases, we had the role of the monarchy. This is the coat of arms of the Glücksburgs, in case you didn't know. So we have the role of the monarchy in all of those cases. The army plays a very, very important role. This picture is the gentleman there is General Condylis. The picture is from the coup of 1935. But again, you have in all crises the presence of the army. And finally, street politics in all three cases. This is from the 60s, but you had street politics, okay, most of the many times organized by the church, by the way, which is, again, an extra-parliamentary institution in Greece. And finally, my third factor is the lack or the insecurity of the middle class. Of course, in the beginning of the 20th century, Greece was a very poor country, no middle class there. There was poverty, there were famines. This is from the 40s until the late 1950s, early 1960s, when you have the emergence of a middle class that was very much insecure, though, and very prone to demagoguery. Okay, now, inside the crisis, we are in the crisis, in a spiral. I will not say much about that. The situation gets worse and worse. So the middle classes suffer. It is within those three crises that we have the biggest waves of emigration from Greece. You have lots of extra-parliamentary politics, and you have bad leadership galore. Okay, now, let me just emphasize this point, the duration of those spirals. They average more than 15 years. I know exactly what you are thinking about right now, but, yeah, you have reason to worry. Now, exiting, though, let us come to something more optimistic. In all of those three cases, Greece was able to get out of those crises. Now, what happened? Now, if you're looking for the single common feature in those three cases, there's one factor, there is one common denominator. Okay, this is leadership. Okay, now, you have Venizelos here in young age. This is about 1910 when he came into power, and then you have General Papagos. And I know you're surprised by me including General Papagos here in 1952, and then you have Karamanlis in 1974. Now, I'm not talking here about the great men, view of history. This is nonsense. I'm talking about politics. And what I want to suggest is that in all three cases, there are six characteristics that those three men had in common. Okay, political characteristics. Which are those? Very briefly, first, all three of them had very, very long political, in the case of Papagos, military as well, personal and political prehistories. Okay, all of them. Venizelos in Crete, Papagos as a military leader, very, very long prehistory, Karamanlis as a prime minister in the 60s. Secondly, all three of them had a very, very clear political vision and policy agendas. So Venizelos, the vision of Venizelos was the modernization of the country and the great idea, of course. The vision of Papagos was law and order, economic development, and the vision of Karamanlis was the building of a new democracy and Europeanization. Very clear policy agendas in the mind of all of those. I've studied all of them. I know what I'm talking about. Third, very important, all three of them created new parties. The Liberal Party, the Greek Rally, New Democracy. Okay, and they brought into politics new political personnel massively, all three of them. Fourth, all three of them made constitutional, radical constitutional changes. Karamanlis, the new constitution of 1975 in reverse order. Papagos, 1952, the constitution and the liberal, the constitutional changes of Venizelos, the constitution of 1911-12. Five. Very important, all three of them had the active support of middle classes. Actually, it is during their rules that the middle class in Greece thrived the most. So we had the early industrialization under Venizelos, and then after the Smyrna disaster, the refugees who came, very entrepreneurial middle class, my grandfather was one of them. Then we had the economic growth of the 50s and 60s, and after 1974, we had, you know, with the Europeanization of Greece, we had the rise of a new middle class. And finally, sixth, very important, all three of them had very, very important, serious political and economic backing by other countries. So Venizelos by the English and the French, Papagos by the Americans, and then Karamanlis by the European Union. So it is politics. It is nothing magic there. It is politics, and there is a pattern. There is a common pattern which is impressive as far as I'm concerned. Forecasting. How am I doing? Do I have another couple of minutes? Enough. Forecasting. Can we escape? How can we escape this time? That's the million-dollar question, I guess, or million euro or pound question. There is this idea in political science, and there is this that political psychologist, Philip Tetlock, who says that we cannot predict, experts cannot predict. Actually, he says that experts are nothing more, nothing better than, you know, dart-throwing chimpanzees, okay, who cannot, are always wrong. I don't like very much this idea. So I want to, there are so many experts here, anyways, I want to propose that, no, it's not true. I mean, we should be able to predict if we know something about history, if we know something about the present. So if you agree with me, or if I convinced you that leadership is a very important factor in escaping those black holes that Greece, and many other countries actually, enter into, and if I convinced you moreover about the six characteristics that I see there, then it is easy. If you think about the personnel in Greece right now, both in government and in opposition, it is easy then to do this exercise. Just tick. Just put positive or negative marks. And then you will be able to tell by yourself whether Greece is likely and when to get out of this crisis. And while you're busy with this exercise, this is my last slide. Thank you very much.
Mountain, and then you didn't answer the question as to whether we should be optimistic or whether we have a surplus of high-quality leadership in Greece today. Let's leave that hanging and invite Kalliopis Banou to speak.
So thank you for this invitation, Professor Featherstone. My presentation has to do with what I think it is an implicit assumption behind any modernization effort undertaken in the past, 40 or even more years. It's not a historical, it doesn't have any historical approach, but rather, how do we do that? No. Okay. Like this. So I would say that during the past, let's say, four decades, Greece seems to be in search of a way to modernize in many different respects: economy, politics, administration, society itself. And Europe has been systematically seen as the most favorable framework for this process. Is EC membership, Euro membership, have raised expectations for advancing modernization. After the achievement of the last, maybe let's say not last, but about two decades, with Euro membership being the most visible one, Greece found itself very vulnerable in a turbulent global environment, since it had not managed to effectively deal with its weaknesses. So the last act was played with the subjection to international custody and the so-called memoranda. Under harsh fiscal austerity, the economic adjustment programs and the conditionality requirements they entailed undertook a kind of forced, targeted economic modernization and selective Europeanization. This again raised some expectations for the revival of this elusive modernization project, which seemed this time to transit again through the increased constraints imposed in this context. So what we see is that we have three increasingly constraining frameworks, and in all three, the common point is the assumption that the external constraint is the decisive factor for modernization. All have been disappointed. Now, what is modernization? How I see modernization? First of all, I focus on modernization because sometimes we mix Europeanization and modernization. Modernization is for me the dependent variable and a number of independent variables affected, one of which is EU-Euro membership. And Europe is defining modernity for Greece. Europe is its immediate geopolitical environment, historical ties, etc., but in many ways, and because also political choice defines modernity. And sometimes Europeanization and modernization are mixed, are not confused, but they are interwoven to the point that we see the challenge and the driver of modernization at the same time. But at the end of the day, Europeanization is a window of opportunity for modernization. But modernization is not Europeanization only. It's a wider sociological process, which refers to, in the Parsonian tradition, it refers to structural and factual differentiation. And this may also happen because of adjustment to external pressure, but also as an endogenous response to an internal demand. Now, in Greece, modernization is a top-down process because Greece is seen as a development laggard, so the initiative comes from the state, from the top. In that sense, political modernization, I define political modernization as the ability of the political system to effectively mediate between outside conditions and domestic modernization requirements. In the Greek case, this involves the reconfiguration of state-society-economy relations in the sense that the domestic governance is not influenced by corporatist interests or patronage interests. In other words, that the political system does not invest the life world of other institutional fields, and the opposite, that it is not invested by other institutional fields or social interests. This, in essence, means that technical instrumental rationality prevails on rationales foreign to the tasks of these political administrative institutions. So, in that sense, Europeanization can assist modernization, but it needs a political agency. Is this idea of mediation between external constraints and domestic requirements. But what has happened, I have the impression, is that equating modernization to Europeanization has led to assume that there is an automatic effect, a kind of spillover effect, which means that since we need to adapt, we will adapt. The adjustment in some way will come automatically. That, in essence, inverses cause and effect. In that sense, we can distinguish three big waves. It's not very strict, chronological order, but still three waves. In the 80s, we talked about a modernization as democratic modernization, but in fact, it was not modernization in the sense I defined a few moments ago. In the 90s, modernization and Europeanization had parallel lives. We had the path to the EMU, economic discipline, and what I consider very important, institutional pluralism, which means creation of a series of institutions that were capable of remodeling state, society, and the common economy relations. And then since 2010, we have the most strict framework, which is conditionality, which leads to a targeted economic modernization. And there, conditionality does not seem to include modernization, but rather normalization. Now, what characterizes these processes is, first of all, we have a kind of soft modernization constraints. As long as Greece was part of the EU or tried to achieve Euro membership, etc., and as a member of the Eurozone, there were soft constraints in the sense that they left that they created incentives and rewards towards specific objectives, but left to political actors to draw lessons and decide on the course of action. This is the experience of Greece in the 90s under Prime Minister Tsimitis, who ensured the political mediation between Europeanization constraints and domestic modernization. So we had parallel lives at that moment. I won't refer to specific examples. If you like, we can discuss that later. But the idea was to create potentially alternative legitimate channels for state society and state economy interaction. Is that something that has to do only with the appearance, is only a morphological adjustment? I don't think so. Institutions matter. But this is not enough for a paradigm change. It is a change that would need more time, more support, more persistence in order to bear fruit. That's one thing. The second thing is that there was, at that time, not enough emphasis on performance modernization in the sense of creating a state apparatus that enables other activities to develop. This performance, the lack of performance modernization, cost in many respects, but also it cost in terms of social support for this project because modernization did not reach the wider population. They didn't see what a modern state, a modernized state, can offer. And there was only just fatigue after a while and no support. And gradually Europeanization absorbed modernization, domestic modernization effort, because Europeanization had more specific targets, deadlines. It was a much more consistent framework, while modernization, domestic modernization, would have to rely on domestic forces. And in my view, this is why modernization lost impact with the loss of European priority. Now, the hard modernization constraints come with the conditionality included in the memoranda. It is the strongest external leverage. But again, at that time, at the beginning, there was some hope that even under very difficult, very constraining circumstances, that could be a push towards modernization. Instead of voluntary learning, of course, we would have, you know, some kind of coercion and direct imposition of a number of things. But still, that could create a kind of momentum for modernization. Is that true? The answer is not clear at this level. I would say there are two aspects. Of course, there has been rationalization. Of course, there have been reform incentives. But in rationalization and reforms in areas that, I mean, were long overdue. But on the other hand, the political system has been completely taken over. The initiative was almost out of the government's hand. The initiative would be to implement or not to implement, but not to decide on when, how, what, priorities, etc. This had us. This provoked a kind of loss of the political capacity to mediate. That's the way I described it earlier, which means the political system did not really mediate between the outside constraints and the domestic requirements, because all of that was more or less imposed. In that sense, a lot of this external, hard external pressure involved a kind of reverse rationality. It promoted fiscally minded or quick fix measures instead of reforms. And at the same time, it led to the downgrading of the quality of legislation, constant changes, deterioration of the capacity of the administration. In that sense, despite whatever formal good intentions, performance modernization was again undermined. So taking away political initiative, this really transformed the political system into an implementation mechanism or following only targeted economic priorities. And also, in terms of Europeanization, only selective European policies. Now, the conclusions, first of all, point to the fact that the capacity to mediate was lost under the most constraining pressure. The reforms undertaken under these conditions of drastic fiscal consolidation increased defensive attitudes and undermined the modernization project and the support for it. What was left from the political capital for modernization seems exhausted. Who currently openly supports modernization as a political project? It now seems to be limited to technicalities and toolkits. It is defined by requirements for the disbursement of vital financial resources. How could it gain the support then of wider groups of the population in these conditions? It is interesting to note that the term modernization itself is sidelined in the political discourse, and the new term is normalization. Greece needs to become a normal country. But normal from inside means it's fine. From outside, normalization means concerns its finance. And from inside, it means normalization of its political operation. But this does not include modernization as a specific project. So in all of this, we can see at best an effort to economic modernization, targeted and selective, but institutional modernization is relegated to a second level. And in that sense, I think that the external constraint approach to modernization has reached its limits. It's not a surprise, because I think there are three important drawbacks in this approach. First of all, it scapegoats others for necessary reforms. The achievements are seen as imposed externally, and it downplays the importance of domestic agency. In that sense, whatever the external constraints in the current situation, modernization via conditionality is rather doomed to fail. Thank you.
Thank you, Kalliopi, for a very interesting presentation. Our final speaker in this session is Dimitris Sotiropoulos.
Good morning. I wish to thank Kevin Featherstone and also Spiros Economidis, who is sitting somewhere in the back, for this invitation. This is a presentation which has taken the call of Kevin Featherstone to the letter. This will be a retrospective on modernization. And perhaps it may be the first presentation today which will not be as pessimistic. Perhaps with the exception of the last 5 minutes of Prime Minister Simitis' hopeful comments about the future of Europe. A very important person in the project of modernization in Greece was Nikos Themelis, a close associate, as you all know, of Prime Minister Simitis. He is reputed to have said that from the modernization period, only cement-built public works will remain. Actually, in Greek, it's even stronger. He's reputed to have said, I'm sorry, I'm going to use Greek, mono ta tsimenta tha minun. Was he correct about this? You can argue about this by looking at different sectors in which modernization has been attempted. And I will look at the sector of public administration, more generally, state organization. What were the administrative innovations in the modernization period between 1993 and 2004? I start from that year, 1993, I end in 2004, exactly because decision makers in that period explicitly claimed that they were following a project of modernization. So what is left of administrative modernization? In more theoretical terms, are there any historical legacies of modernization which we owe to that period? Were there any pathways created? Modernization in this presentation is taken what sociologists usually understand with the term differentiation of structures and processes to adapt to changes in the national and the international environment. More concretely, modernization in Greece, I think, has taken the meaning which we usually assign to words like westernization and Europeanization. Obviously, these are contested terms, but again, I'm taking the perspective of the people, the decision makers in particular, who attempted to modernize Greece by making it converge with the rest of the European Union member states, more broadly, perhaps, the OECD advanced economies. And I will use this term, modernization, in the concrete way which you see in my third paragraph. The effort in reorganizing the administration was to rebalance the legality of administrative action, which was prevalent in Greece and still is to some extent, with the state's new strategic role in economic development. This was the 1990s, a period in which, throughout the world, there was much discussion about the need to grant the state a new role. That was the task to lead economic development not in the old way of state interventionism. Rather, the state was assigned the task to play a strategic role, namely the state should become leaner and at the same time adopt a hands-off attitude towards economic production. So the state was given the role of steering the economy. How was this manifested in four different sectors of administrative modernization in Greece? My first sector is reform of administrative organization and procedures, and I have written in bold the years in which we have major changes, either the passage of important legislation or the establishment of new institutions. So between 1993 and 2004, as you see, we have examples which, in my mind at least, have set a pathway. First of all, regional elections and decentralization. The year 1994 was the first time we had elections for regional governors in Greece. Then, in 1997, we have the first very important decentralization reform, the Kapodistrias reform, which was amended much later in 2010. The Code of Administrative Procedure, which basically means that there is a standard way in which civil servants are expected to process documents and produce acts. Then a rather optimistic and probably not implemented umbrella reform program, which was named Politeia, Polity. And finally, the least implemented law, which was the Management by Objectives, a way that is to make the civil service try not so much to adapt its acts to what the law says, but rather to produce concrete outcomes. In my second sector, I'm going to talk very briefly about reform of human resources and management. Again, we have a development which I think you would agree set a pathway. We have the establishment of the independent authority, which was and still is in charge of recruitment of new employees to the public sector, ASEP. It was established in 1994. You will notice in this slide and in my remaining slides that I also have other dates. These are dates years in which there have been amendments to original legislation. That is a very important part of the story, and it is also less advantageous development, because successive governments, including from the same governing party, tried to change the initial legislation, sometimes justifiably, other times not so justifiably, and thus we have the phenomenon of excessive regulation, repetitive regulation, contradictory regulation. Anyhow, it is very important also that in the year 1999, for the first time since 1951, we had a new civil service code, which was very important in order to make sure that the civil service, and particularly the civil servants themselves, know what are their rights and also their duties. Finally, we have in 2003 a law which recast the National School of Public Administration that was established many, many years before, but that law is considered to be today very important for the functioning of that school. In my next sector, reform of citizen administration relations, we have something which I think most Greeks would consider to be the most important outcome of administrative modernization. That is the last paragraph there, the citizens' service centers, the KEP, as we call them in Greek, which have been indeed new points of contact between citizens and administrators that clearly have made the lives of many Greek citizens much more easy regarding their contact with public bureaucracy. On the other hand, experts and lawyers say that another very important development in the same period is the establishment of new modes of accessing public documents. Already that was available in 1986, but mainly a law of 1997 regulated such access. And also we have the electronic signature in documents, which was not really very much implemented. The last sector I'm going to address is probably the most important, and that has to do with the understanding of modernization that was given to us in the first slide shown today by Kevin Featherstone. If you remember, in that slide, at the very end, it said, repeating the words of Kostas Simitis, that modernization also means the establishment of new ways of regulating economic and social life. And that means that the establishment of new institutions has the double task of, on the one hand, making public bureaucracy more efficient, and secondly, much more important, I think, the establishment of such new authorities plays a different role, the role of making democracy better, by which I mean liberal democracy, which, as you know, often has the tendency of allowing executive power, the government, to become indeed extremely powerful. There is a way which liberal democracies have tried to apply in order to balance off these aggrandizing tendencies of modern governments, and this is through the introduction of balancing authorities. And here I have some examples of such new authorities which were established in the modernization period I'm talking to you about. The Personal Data Protection Authority, the Greek Ombudsman, the Inspectors of Public Administration, and the General Inspector of Public Administration. Again, as you see, we have amendments to this legislation. A tendency which has unfortunately become extreme in the other cases I now show, a very important new organization which was set in order to make the absorption of European community funds more efficient. MOD, Management Organization Unit, was amended many, many times. Then we also have the Hellenic Authority for Communication, Security and Privacy. And the most troublesome of all those new institutions, the National Council for Radio and Television, which has been, as you know, either neglected or more recently attacked. The last slide on new independent and administrative authorities has to do with Hellenic Capital Market Commission management and the Hellenic Competition Commission, which is the oldest of these regulatory organizations but acquired new life during the period of modernization. There was also, in the modernization period, some legislation regarding anti-corruption and accountability. A very important law still active, still applied, is the Political Party Financing Law of 2002. The criminal responsibility of government ministers, and perhaps the most important of these laws, the asset declaration, which has to do with the obligation of many political and administrative officials to declare their assets every year. Was everything great in that period? No, that would have been unnatural. I then present here some policy issues in administrative reform which probably were unattended or were not, let's say, elaborated quickly enough to become new bills of law. The municipal code and the reorganization of local government, which were regulated much later, in 2006 and 2010. The very important fiscal controls on public services, which if they had been in place, perhaps we could have avoided partly the fiscal derailment about which previous speakers have talked. The transparency and anti-corruption legislation in civil service, the Avia law, and leaner ministerial structures, which were legislated in 2014, and a stronger prime minister's office. Of course, as you know, research by Featherstone and Papadimitriou has shown that during the period of Kostas Simitis as prime minister, we already have some strengthening of the prime minister's office. But my point here, and also I think that holds for the next slide, is that without the external constraints imposed by the economic adjustment programs of Greece, such legislative changes would not have taken place in administration. For example, the evaluation of civil servants, which was attempted in 2014 and amended only a few months ago and still is not practiced. Public tenders and public procurement, there was legislation about this, and in the modernization period, there was even a new secretariat for public procurement, but I guess without the external constraints put to us, to Greece, over the last 7 years, the new legislation on public procurement would not have taken place. The regulatory impact assessment, RIA, which was introduced by the Karamanlis government, was never implemented. And then we have the coordination of anti-corruption. That is a story with various meanders and started in 2013 and progressed in 2015 with the introduction of a whole new ministry. And finally, an issue which was not attended very well during the administrative modernization period was the mushrooming of temporary public employment jobs, a phenomenon very well known to students of the Italian public administration, the Greek public administration, the Southeast European public administration. It's not only a Greek phenomenon. Overall, progress made not in public administration, but particularly in government organization. We have periodic meetings of and substantive discussions in the government's cabinet. In that period, the cabinet was not a rubber stamping agency. There were substantive discussions. Secondly, in the wider public sector, an area in which I have not the time to go into, there have been more determined attempts to modernize state-owned enterprises. The most well-known examples are the ENOTE. Then we have more clear policy targets set by the Prime Minister and the Prime Minister's office, and monitoring of ministers by the Prime Minister's office in an attempt to create something different out of the traditional fragmented feudal-like system of Greek ministers and ministries. Nevertheless, many of these efforts I'm talking about and part of the legislation of the administrative modernization was not implemented, and that has to do with many factors, including the fact that the governing party was not always in accord with the government. The conclusion is that the modernization included much more than cement-built works. I think I have shown this with regard to administrative reform. The modernizing governments of 1993 to 2004, the main concern of which was to prepare Greece to join the Eurozone, have attempted to modernize the public administration too. Although many issues were unattended, administrative reform successes included decentralization, recruitment to the public sector, agencification, by which we mean the establishment of new institutions, and better citizen-administrative relations. I think there was a successful rebalancing of the two roles of the Greek state about which I talked in the beginning. On the one hand, we had an emphasis on spreading, diffusing legality in the way the administration was supposed to function. And on the other hand, we had a new role assigned to the Greek state to steer the Greek economy into the European economy. The memory of Nikos Themelis is dear to many of us, but on the remains of modernization, I think he was wrong. Thank you.
Thank you to each of these speakers. I'm not sure whether my microphone is on, but hopefully you can hear me. We have, I think, 15, 20 minutes for discussion. I'm going to, with the approval of my colleagues here, take about three questions at a time. There's a microphone coming to you. Can I, Dimitris Papadimitriou?
Thank you very much. I have a question for Takis, but also for the other panelists as well, that relate to what we may call the vehicle of modernization. And the three examples that Takis used in his presentation contrast with the example of the 1990s, whereby the agenda of modernization was pursued through the effective capture of an existing party. And many in Greece and outside Greece have accused or have pointed to the fact that precisely because Tsimitis attempted this agenda through PASOK, there were inherent limitations to it. But there are others, and I think I probably belong to the second category, that think that the pursuit of this agenda through a party like PASOK made it possible for this agenda to be pursued in power. And, of course, many of these issues are relevant today. I mean, what is the best strategy for pursuing such a such an agenda? There are people here who were involved in Thrasi, in Potami, and so on, who spoke to people that agree with them but didn't make it to power. It is perhaps worth thinking about the future and how can we ensure that such kind of an agenda acquires purchase in Greece.
Thank you very much indeed. Several hands in the centre, Thalia. Can you please just give your names as well?
Yes, Thalia Magioglou, visiting fellow from the Hellenic Observatory. I enjoyed a lot all the talks, and I have a question, I think, for the three speakers. Using what Kevin and Prime Minister Tsimitis have mentioned, one thing relates to the importance of globalization. Listening to your talks about modernization, I had the feeling that we were focusing on Greece, on what is happening inside the frontiers of Greece. At the same time, there are these globalizing forces, not just the markets that are international, European integration also, different dynamics in Europe, more conservatism the last years, as Prime Minister Tsimitis has pointed. And at the same time, and this is not from my research in political psychology, maybe we have different Greeces also in Greece, different regions with different characteristics. And would it be interesting for looking at the future to take into consideration the differences and also the talents or the capacities of the regions in order to find a bridge between a sort of more modernizing. Well, Giddens is looking at us from his portrait over there, and he has discussed a lot this notion. But yes, so my question is, should we take into consideration the fact that we are states also change and that time is not the same? Takis Papas mentioned 15-something years of crisis, in previous crisis, but with technologies, time is not exactly, in my feeling, the same nowadays than what it was at the 19th century. Maybe there is an intensification of processes because of these technological inventions. Thank you.
Thank you. could we take Platon at the front, please, and then we'll...
Thank you. Platon Tinios from University of Piraeus. We're using modernization in two senses here. There's modernization with a small M, which is a process that is a target, ultimately, and modernization with a capital M, which is what happened in Greece between 1996 and 2004. Now, that is not just a formal point, because we are assuming implicitly that the targets remain, that they're set in stone. And, for example, Nikos Themelis mentioned that he was talking of cement, but he could also be using cement figuratively to mean that we have created the institutions, but unfortunately the crisis could mean that the institutions exist and have provided wonderful titles for people, but did not deliver what they were meant to deliver. And my question really is for, well, primarily to Dimitris Sotiropoulos, but also for the others, is have these very real advances that were attained by modernization with the capital M taken us closer to what modernization with a small M would be? Or have they just provided more jobs for boys and girls?
Thank you very much indeed. There's a question here, please.
Thank you. My name is Diego Iscara from IHS Market, and I would like to pick on the idea of Europe as a driver of modernization. But in particular, one of Professor Spano's conclusions that modernization through conditionality is destined to fail, and it's something I very much agree on. And my question is, in practical terms, what can Europe do, what other alternatives, approaches Europe can take to become, again, an efficient and positive driver for modernization in Greece? Thank you.
Thank you. And then the last question in this round, if we could take Pascal.
I just wanted, Pascos Mandravelis, I'm from Kathmerini newspaper. I just wanted a clarification from Mr. Papas. What kind of crisis started in 1961? Was it the political crisis by the rigged elections of 1961, which led to dictatorship? But this was a plan that was detailed, that was created after the Civil War, the Pericles Plan. So there is not a political crisis that starts in 1961. There is a political crisis that starts during Papagos era, actually. Just to clarify this.
Okay, thanks. In the, because of the time constraint, I think if we just go across the panel and if you could address the main questions to yourself as briefly as possible, please. Take it. Do you want to start?
Yes. With the exception of Pascos, I did not receive any concrete question, but by taking a few points here and there, Dimitris mentioned agenda, acquiring purchase, Thalia, she talked about different regions and time and modernization. What do we mean by modernization, Platon? I think that the main idea here is that we have reforms that fail. I mean, modernizing reforms for modernization that fail time and again in Greece for many, many decades now. So this is a crisis of modernization, clearly, and what we have to think about is why those reforms have failed, or why those reforms, once implemented sometimes, or once introduced, I'm sorry, they are not implemented. Okay, talking about health, talking about education, et cetera, et cetera. So my crucial point here is that what is lacking, what is missing here is social legitimation. There is not legitimation for those reforms. Now, why is my next question, because Greece has a tendency to fall, to enter into crisis spirals, as I explained. Now, let me say one word more about what those crisis spirals are and how do I conceive them, and by this way I will answer Pascos's question, hopefully. I'm talking about reversals of constitutional democracy in Greece. I mean, we have a process of democratic constitutionalism since the Archites de Dilomenes in 1875, which has had many reversals. And those reversals are marked by political instability and bad economic situation in the country. Now, I'm talking about chains of failure. There is no, when you enter into such a process, there is no respite. So when you enter in 1961 into a process of democratic delegitimation, okay, the delegitimation of the system, there is no respite up to 1974. You go from crisis to crisis. Long duration is a very crucial characteristic here. And the crisis affects the entire population, so it has nothing to do with regions or social classes. The entire population is involved into a huge political and economic crisis. And there is always a sense, my final point, a sense of social asphyxiation in those cases. Societies feel a sense of helplessness, like it's happening right now in Greece. I think this is my point. So I think, well, there, I mean, what I presented today is quite obviously a new book I've just finished, and it will come up soon, so you will have the opportunity to read more about that. Thank you very much.
I guess the Richard's Path of Mitri's question was modernization via PASOK as a party ultimately a problem?
Well, yes, that was my previous book, by the way. I mean, I talk about populism in Greece, and I think
on the assumption we can't always buy the books.
I think that PASOK. No, I mean that's. I didn't. I mean, I work on populism, but I didn't mention the word once earlier. But I think that PASOK was a modernizing party that got involved into this populist, you know, vortex. I think that. You know, I do not consider that it was a period of crisis, of course. The years from 1981 to 2008, it was a period of growth, development, et cetera, et cetera. But a crisis was brewing. And the crisis was a crisis of lack of legitimacy to the parliamentary institutions, I think, to the liberal democratic institutions. Dimitri mentioned the word earlier. Okay? So I think that there was a continuous erosion of those liberal democratic institutions, and PASOK was not able, especially under the two terms by Simitis, I think, to stop that erosion. I mean, this is my interpretation.
Calliope.
Yes. Now, my point is that we have been relying too much on the external approach, external constraint approach. And in many ways, we thought it would be an automatic process. things would go that way because we are in Euro, because we are in the Euro. And now because we are under custody. So I think that in all three cases, there were a lot of disappointments as long as there was no political agency domestically. When there was political agency domestically, then the external constraint was mediated, was taken up, and the adjustment has made some steps. We may need more, but that's another story. It has advanced. But as long as there is no domestic political agency, it won't work. Now, what happens is that conditionality imposes a very, very strict framework, which after a while, it produces some positive effects, I cannot deny that. But after a while, it deprives the political system of the initiative and of the idea of active agency to take initiatives, believing that this is what has to be done, not just because we are told that we have to do it. And what happens is that while it is very, very strict on the governments and the political actors, at the same time, it delegitimizes, it undermines the modernization project in political terms and in social terms. It has many side effects, counter effects even. And it is important to see that there won't be political agency as long as there is not some social support for this project. And I think we are now in the opposite direction. We're going down. There is no support for a modernization project. And whatever reforms are advanced or are introduced, I'm sorry, very much it's a very formal process. We don't really feel that we just tick boxes. We have to do this and we have to do that. But I don't see who supports modernization right now, who openly supports modernization. I have the feeling that this project was politically defeated for the time being, at least. Now, what Europe can do, that's a big question. I think that the country needs apart from fiscal, political space. Because otherwise there will not be any political agency. And only forces who really do not believe in modernization will prevail, because they can promise anything.
Thank you very much. If you could just indulge me for 1 minute. I agreed with every word you've just said. Of course, when people look across Europe, we think of the case of Portugal. We know from the literatures on IMF rescues that domestic ownership is indeed crucial to the success, the apparent success or the real success of IMF rescues. So I can see that in the Greek case, the validity of the argument that external intervention has simply provoked a backlash and has indeed undermined a modernizing or modernizers coalition. It hasn't in Portugal. Party leaders across the spectrum have talked about ownership of the rescue program. And I can see that it's a matter of choice. But if you don't have that external constraints, if it's not the European Union doing it, it'll be the financial markets. And you simply then allow learning by catastrophe, as it were. And what you seem to imply is that the alternative is some kind of golden hand, that ultimately society will learn the constraints and society will take ownership of an agenda that is necessary for reform. I wonder if you could just come back quickly.
Yes, I will.
Thank you.
I think that, first of all this idea of ownership, I'm quite critical about it, because nobody talks about the factors that shape ownership, that create ownership, shape it, and preserve it, maintain it. So that's a big discussion. So we cannot take for granted that one country took ownership or the other took ownership or did not take ownership. My view of Greece is that, unfortunately, we didn't realize that the best way to deal with it is to get rid of it as soon as possible. And that's what Portugal understood. So that has to do with political, assessment of the situation. We thought we could change, we could... I believe that Portugal, this is also a kind of hypothesis, but hypothesis was in a better state in many respects, but at the same time I don't think that the reforms, the depth of the reforms and the stringent way of imposing reforms was the same in Portugal, and they were maybe a bit cleverer, so that they did what they had to do and get out of it. And if you look deeper, maybe the changes are not as deep as they have to be in Greece. So it is a matter also, and I have had the opportunity to talk in some other context. In many ways, Portugal may have been the construction of a success and Greece the construction of a failure. In order to have a failure, you have a success and the opposite.
Very good answer. Thank you.
This wonderful discussion, which my two colleagues started, can be continued in the following way. The big difference between Greece, on the one hand, and Portugal, Spain, Cyprus, and Ireland, on the other hand, I think, is a twofold difference. The first is the problems of Greece were much more grave. I think this is uncontested. And secondly, I would like to submit to you that in the first period of the adoption of memoranda of understanding by Spain and Portugal, political forces and also trade unions took a different stance from our political parties and trade unions. Until the Portuguese government took excessive measures, and until, in the case of Spain, accusations of mismanagement and corruption against the Partido Popular
became very, very strong, these two countries followed a way out of the crisis on which there was basic agreement. In that sense, there was domestic ownership to the extent that domestic ownership can help bring about reforms, which we did not have in Greece. In that sense, I'm arguing that it's one thing to try to, let's say, enforce domestic ownership from above into a country, and on that issue, Kalliopis Panou is correct. On the other hand, there must be a social base for reform to take place, for modernization to unravel. And that brings me to the first question by Dimitris Papadimitriou. What was the role of PASOK? The role of PASOK, I guess, was both supportive and at the same time, depending on the situation, less supportive, less helpful. Without an initial alliance among the governing elite of that time, the 1990s, the trade union leaders and the Greek entrepreneurial classes, there would not have been reforms which took place between 1993 and 2004. On the other hand, we do know that in specific sectors, including some of the administrative reforms I have mentioned, and obviously the most clear case in the reform of the pension system, the role of PASOK was much less supportive, to put it mildly. And that means that the answer to the question by Dimitris Papadimitriou is yes and no. And also, with regard to what Thalia Magioglou said, yes, we have many different Greeces. She used the term in the plural, not only because there still are many underdeveloped regions in our country, given that some of the regions of Greece, such as Western Macedonia and Epirus, started from a very low development level and other regions were much more advanced. We have the same phenomenon today. We have many Greeces because, as you know, there is a long discussion based on the work of Diamandouros whether we have two different cultures in Greece. And I'm afraid we also have two Greeces. Again, the word is used in plural today because there is the Greece of the young people who have, as we speak now, almost no options in their professional lives, and some of them tend to leave, and the Greece and the other Greece of the middle-aged group and the old-aged group who probably now seem to inhabit a different country from the country which the young Greeks now inhabit. Regarding the question of Platon Tinios, to the best of my understanding, the effort which took place after 1993 was an effort actually to make the two terms, modernization with small m and modernization with capital M, to converge. And in the topics at least I have talked about, yes, the answer is that there has been modernization in the sense that governments which followed, which also made some steps towards modernization without claiming that they were following the Simitis project, indeed used past successes, past achievements. So the Karamanlis government used the ASEP, and also supported the National School of Public Administration. The Karamanlis government also, as you know, tried to reform and modernize the civil service code. And my answer then to Platon Tinios' question is that there have been advances which were not too many or perhaps not sufficient to prevent Greece from reaching the point of near default, but we still use today some of the institutions and legislation which we owe to the period of administrative modernization.
Thank you very much.
Just
10 seconds.
Less, even. No, I just want to say, because we very often compare Greece to Portugal and Spain, that we tend to forget what is the most important difference between those two countries, three countries, that Portugal has never had a populist party so far, even with the crisis, and that Spain had the populist party Podemos only in 2014. That is 6 years into the Spanish economic crisis. Okay, Greece, you know. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you very much indeed. Can we take a 10-minute break? But join me in thanking our panelists.